From the Society of American Archivists, this is Archives in Context, a podcast highlighting archival literature and technologies, and most importantly, the people behind them.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Archives in Context. My name's Anna Trammell, and I'm here with my co-host, Chris Burns.
Hi, everyone. During this special season of Archives in Context, in which we examine how the events of 2020 and now 2021 have affected archivists, we want to remind all of our listeners to consider supporting the Archival Workers Emergency Fund. You can find out more through the SAA website at www.archivists.org.
Today, we are here with Alexis Androcoli, Annalise Berdini, Faith Charlton, Valencia Johnson, and Katie Rawdon, who are members of the Anti-Racist Description Working Group of Archives for Black Lives in Philadelphia. Archives for Black Lives in Philadelphia is a volunteer-run organization based in the Philadelphia and Delaware Valley area and has worked on projects in response to issues raised by the Black Lives Matter movement. These projects include publishing a statement of principles and anti-racist description resources. We are so pleased to have members of the Anti-Racist Description Working Group here to speak with us today about the anti-racist description resources, which they published in 2019. Welcome, Alexis, Annalise, Faith, Valencia, and Katie.
Hello, everyone. So before we talk about the anti-racist description resources, could you introduce yourselves?
Sure, no problem. My name is Valencia Johnson, and I'm the archivist for student life at Princeton University.
And I'm Faith Charlton. I'm the lead processing archivist for Manuscripts Division Collections, also at Princeton University.
I'm Alexis Androcoli, and I am the Assistant University Librarian for Special Collections Technical Services, also at Princeton University.
I'm Annalise Berdini. I am the Digital Archivist in Special Collections at Princeton University.
And I'm Katie Rawdon. I'm Coordinator of Technical Services at Temple University's Special Collections Research Center.
Great. Well, thank you all for being here. So now that you've introduced yourselves, could you tell us about Archives for Black Lives in Philadelphia and how this effort began?
This work was inspired by Teresa Rayford, Teresa is an activist. She leads an organization called Don't Shoot PDX. And we were connected with her for the Liberated Archives Forum for a presentation at SAA in 2017. And in talking with Teresa about her experiences using archives, she pointed out some experiences that she had had with really racist descriptions that she had come across. And she asked if there was any guidance for archivists on how to handle these issues, and we had no answer for her. And so we thought that creating something to guide archivists who, especially archivists at predominantly white institutions, who probably have legacy description that is racist, that creating resources for them to do that legacy cleanup work would be useful. And that's how we got started on this project.
I can add just quickly, because Alexis had mentioned, talking about the group generally and kind of, I guess, just in addition to what you already mentioned about the group, one kind of cool thing is that the group is now in the SAA Dictionary of Archives Terminology, which is really great recognition for the group. But we actually now have probably close to 180 members of the group, archivists, librarians, and allied professionals, like you mentioned. And it was established in the summer of 2016, led by a group of Philadelphia area professionals under the leadership of Rachel Appel, who's a librarian at the University of Pennsylvania Library, in response to issues raised by the Black Lives Matter movement. And in particularly, it was a response to Princeton's former digital archivist Jarrett Drake's 2016 ALA address, where he talked about his work to end archives erasure of Black lives and coined the hashtag Archives for Black Lives. So just a little bit more background on the group itself.
Great, thank you. So Alexis started to get into this a little bit, but one of the big projects that has come out of Archives for Black Lives in Philadelphia is the anti-racist description resources. Can you tell our listeners a little more about these resources and maybe each of you individually about your role in this particular project?
Sure. It was really a grassroots thing, and I came in a little bit towards the middle of the project. But we tapped our networks to see people who had the time and the availability to work on it. We did a lot of reading. We surveyed the professional literature. We have this massive spreadsheet still that has all the articles and the books that we've read and our thoughts and our summaries about it. So we can build up our base of knowledge so we were able to communicate effectively and coherently about some of the metadata changes and interventions you can do at your own institution and what we've done at our respective institutions such as Temple and at Princeton. And it's resources. It's not prescriptive. It's not the end-all be-all of anti-racist description. And since we are Archives for Black Lives in Philadelphia, we focused on anti-blackness and how black people and black bodies are described. But there are some transferable skills and methods that you can use for a lot of historically marginalized groups and communities as well. But we wanted to be really clear about our specific focus and to make sure that people go out and do their own research as well. Like you said, we published this in 2019 and we did a small, tiny update later. But there's so much more. The profession has moved. There's much more out there. And we just want to make sure that people don't see us as authorities, because we're not. We're standing on the shoulders of others. But I'll let my co-authors jump in and give more context.
Yeah, I guess I'll say, and this is Faith, in terms of process, just to add to what Valencia said. So kind of the working group was split into two groups, basically, and one of the groups of a few members was kind of working on the metadata recommendations, and then the other group was working on the annotated bibliography that we kind of culled from the huge, massive bibliography that Valencia mentioned. And then we kind of came together and drafted, the entire document, we can speak about this later, but we also had Black archivists and professionals review the guidelines, and we all kind of reviewed their feedback once we received that and incorporated it into the resources together as a group. So that's kind of how we, I guess, broke up the work. And I should mention, too, while we're talking about processes and those involved, two members of the working group who aren't here, just want to give a shout out to Kelly Boulding, who's also at Princeton, and Mandy Ferreira, who is also at Princeton, were part of the working group that drafted the resources.
Yeah, and I just wanted to follow up on that, because you mentioned in the introduction to these resources that you're approaching this work as mostly white women working in predominantly white institution. So what blind spots did you become aware of as you were working on this project? And can you talk a little bit more about how you involved Black archivists in this work?
Before I let my colleagues answer, I just want to, for our listeners who won't see our faces, Valencia Johnson is a Black archivist, and Mandy Farrar is also a Black woman archivist as well.
Yeah, this is Annalise. I think one of the things that is important to stress that Valencia has already mentioned is that we did not come into this as experts. We are just people who wanted to do a better job, that we're aware of problems in our institutions and in the field. And the amount of research and reading that we did at the beginning, like, cannot be overstated how long that took and how much reading each person did individually. That doesn't eradicate any of the blind spots. And they kind of, I think that there were plenty that arose during the writing process. We had, you know, the Black community is not a monolith and there are disagreements. One of the major ones I think that we can talk about is whether or not to capitalize Black in the guidelines. And Valencia had an opinion and many of the readings that we read had an opinion and they were not necessarily in alignment. And there was a lot of learning that we had to do, the white women in the group, when that conversation kind of got brought to the forefront and those disagreements and I think listening got, and how important it is to really sit and listen from a place of not knowing. That skill became very apparent as being one of the most important things about doing these guidelines. And we didn't all come into this process with that skill. So that was one of the areas I think that I remember coming up in particular. Yeah. So reading and talking and listening and doing more reading and talking and listening, those were crucial to this process.
Yeah, I think the experiences that we encountered as a group, like Annalise mentioned, you know, were really a learning experience for the white women in the group in particular. And also, you know, per your question, we really wanted to have community input for the resources, particularly from Black archivists. So we established a GoFundMe and successfully raised over $1,000 and were able to pay 9 Black archivists to review and provide feedback on the resources, like I mentioned earlier. And we are very grateful to everyone who donated money and also to the reviewers for their time and expertise, because their feedback was really insightful and constructive and, you know, essential to the success of the project. So we were really happy to be able to do that, to provide an honoraria, to have those folks review and provide feedback. And like I said, we incorporated all of it into the resources. So that was a component of the project as well. And sorry, Katie, I think you were going to say something.
Oh, yeah, sure. This is Katie. And so I just wanted to echo what Annalise said about the not knowing and sort of embracing your not knowing when trying to do this sort of work. I work at Temple University. We have a very diverse student body. Our collections are, in general, fairly diverse themselves in terms of who they represent. And so I've been working there for some time, and yet going through this process of doing that reading and discussing what we'd read and coming up with these recommendations and having disagreements and learning that sometimes, you know, the thing about blind spots is you don't know what they are. You don't know what you don't know. And for me, that was really valuable. Just in terms of bringing that back to my own work, one of my responsibilities is overseeing archival description at Temple, and having that experience of the value of looking outside of your own opinion, the value of really reaching for a broad range of readings, range of other opinions, and then, as Annalise also said, sitting and listening, I think has really informed my work. Like, the process of working on these resources has informed the way I now go about my own work at my job.
So I take to heart Valencia's earlier point about the anti-racist description resources not being the authoritative document, the prescriptive guide to how to do this work. That said, I hope you all know, and I think you do, what an important contribution you've made to this conversation and to the field with this work, and that your experience can be helpful to others. So with that in mind, I would ask the question about how would you recommend that archivists get started on projects aimed at addressing racist or anti-Black description in their own repositories?
You know, I saw a comment on Twitter. I don't actually tweet, but I browse Twitter sometimes, by Dorothy Berry, about I'm a Twitter lurker, about people who take a sort of a purely computational approach to this. And I thought she made a really good point that, like, this is hard work, right? It's not just about replacing out-of-date terms, for example. This takes if I've learned anything, it's like this takes a lot of time and this is really hard work. And while this is not archival description, I recently wrote a really brief piece for our library news. And it was about materials that I have acquired for our early American history collections. And one of the pieces I was writing about documented a free Black woman in Maryland in the early 19th century. And just even writing that paragraph took a lot of time and a lot of thought to do, right? And so, you know, I think an important part of getting started is understanding that this is hard, that it takes time, and that you're going to have to constantly redo it, right? Like, you just have to pay constant attention to it. So I guess that is the advice I would give to people starting on this.
And I would also ask people to be brave and know going in that you are going to make a misstep somewhere. Doing this type of work and expanding into like DEI work, you're gonna harm someone, because, and that's not your goal, but it's gonna happen. That's something you have to figure out how you're gonna process and be accountable for and try to remedy that and rectify it. I don't think you should go in thinking that you're never going to harm someone and that you're never going to make a mistake, because you're kind of setting yourself up for failure. And also, like, extend yourself some grace in that too, because you're dealing with feelings, you're dealing with something that's very personal, because it's how you're describing people and how you're describing communities, and try not to forget that. I think what Alexis was saying, like, thinking, like, computational, like, it's just, but it has real-life impact to people.
Yeah, my contribution to this is related to the people, and that's, you know, part of doing this work is changing the culture, too, of working in archives. Our culture has been one that has created a harmful environment in history and in the present. And it helps to have other people to talk to who are also trying to do this work and who you can kind of work through your questions and your challenges with. So even if, you know, it's great to have buy-in from the top and have people supporting you while you do this, but that's not always possible at every institution. And there are plenty of people who oppose doing this kind of thing. So if you can find anybody, some kind of cohort to talk to, I know that that has been really helpful. And, you know, going beyond finding resources, and we've had a wealth of incredible resources to learn from when we did this project, and there's even more now, as people have said, but going even beyond that and actually just talking to people who are doing this work or who want to do this work, I think that's really important and can be really helpful, like getting out of just your own head.
Well, some of you and your responses have kind of touched on how this research and talking to each other about these resources have kind of changed your way of thinking or approaching your work. But can any of you talk about specific ways that you have applied these resources at your own institutions?
I'll speak on behalf of Kelly Balding, who is our fearless leader for the Inclusive Description Working Group at Princeton. And the work to do reparative description started before our team was formalized in manuscripts with the team over there doing an audit of our finding aids and figuring out where we have harmful language and starting to know where they're at in our data and then having conversations about what are the right steps to remedy that. Is it changing the language? Is it changing our processes, how we think about who gets a biohist, who gets a long scope and content note, which I think is what Alexis and Elise were trying to get at, is like, it's not, it goes bigger. It should change your workflow and not just terms. And it should change how you approach it overall and make you more intentional and mindful about how you're describing people and the power that you have and the lasting impact that we as archivists have in shaping how people interact with our collections.
We've had similar conversations at Temple. We are hoping to do an audit of our description. For the past year and a half, we've been migrating to archive space, so that hasn't been happening yet. Many things have not been happening yet. But we've also approached this in terms of looking at the language we use, but also more broadly, as Valencia said, like who gets a biohist note, how do we construct those notes? Is the format that is sort of traditional for creating this information, who does that benefit? Who does it not benefit? Does it really benefit our researchers? Does it really benefit all of our researchers? Those kind of conversations. So not just like, do we use this term? Do we not use this term? That sort of thing. More broadly looking at sort of the in-house style that is assumed to be, you know, this is how we do a Temple finding aid, and looking at whether there's a better, more inclusive, honestly just better for our patrons way to construct that kind of information. And it's ongoing. I mean, this is like, if there's one thing I've learned about just description in general, it's iterative, it's ongoing. If you commit to doing this work, you have to keep doing it. It doesn't suddenly get done.
Yeah, I just want to say that this has, in terms of, I don't do a lot of the hands-on work anymore in my role, but piggybacking on what Valencia and Annalise were saying to answer an earlier question about this work being about people, that it's really, I've always thought that, right? That's always been a motivation for me and something that I believe, but it's really reinforced that. And it's a soapbox that I spend a lot of time on, because I think our profession has traditionally been very focused on the materials. And of course, we care about the materials or we wouldn't be here. But at the end of the day, the materials only matter because of people and the meaning that people make of them. And so this is about the people who use our collections, the people who are represented in our collections, and, you know, the interactions they have with each other you know, when they come together. And so it's really reinforced that for me, that this is about human beings.
So looking at the impact that these resources that you put together have had on the field. In the fall of 2020, you sent out a survey to gather information about how archivists have been using the anti-racist description resources and feedback on where the resources could be improved. Could you share with us some of the results of that survey and how it might inform future work?
I have one thing I would love to address. It was really interesting. We got a lot of really great feedback. But one thing that I think we've talked about a couple of times as a group is that people really want an authority or an expert who's telling them exactly how to do this work. And as we have said multiple times, we're not that. We are people who wanted really very much to do better. And we're like, you know, this is something that could be helpful. But there are so many other people doing this work already and creating new resources, new writings. And we got a lot of submissions with, hey, like, why didn't you include this one? This is so great. And it's like, well, that was after we wrote it. But, you know, I would say that this is something that we carved out time for and just kind of started doing. And I think that if you want to do this work, then that is how you start. You carve out time, you find things to help you, and you start by looking for something easy. Like, everybody knows the most offensive finding aids in their collections. Start there and see if you can start to fix them, because that's usually low-hanging fruit, and then you can kind of dig into the more complicated work beyond that. So that was one thing I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, just to add to that, this is Faith. We, like Annalisa said, we did have a really great response rate. We actually had 50 folks respond to the survey, which was really awesome. Just to share a little bit of information about the responses, most, not surprisingly, were from academic institutions or affiliated with academic institutions. And, you know, a lot of the people who responded have been able to implement the resources in some way to either address legacy description and or, you know, include in local guidelines for creating new description. But we're currently reviewing the feedback, and we intend to publish a report about the feedback that we received, and maybe something else in addition to that. But the group is currently working on that right now. so we'll be releasing, you know, results and analysis of that maybe by the end of the year, fingers crossed, but sometime in the near-ish future.
Great. I'm going to ask a quick follow-up, and your answer may be a one-word answer, presumably in the affirmative, which is, just sort of curious, it certainly seems like from what I've seen across various listservs and discussions, that two things in the past year may have contributed to people really focusing in this area a lot, being all of the remote work we've all been doing due to the pandemic, you know, due to the anti-racist demonstrations that sort of took off across the country following the murder of George Floyd last summer. So does that resonate with you? Is that what you were seeing yourselves and in the survey results that this work really took off even more so in the last year?
No, it's we've been trying to parse out the data because we have a lot of qualitative answers. I think the biggest contributing factor is remote work. It's being able to dedicate time because we're working off site and without our collections. That's been the biggest impact. But in terms of like institutional support, it probably has more to do with the Black Lives Matter protest over the summer.
So we're looking forward to seeing more about the results of the survey. So that's exciting to hear that you all are at work on that. But can you tell us about other initiatives that we may be able to expect from Archives for Black Lives in Philadelphia, and maybe speak about some of the opportunities archivists may have to get involved in that work?
Sure. This is Faith. I can give a response to that. The group, actually, we just had an open meeting for everyone. We're going to be holding those quarterly from now on. We just started doing that and had a lot of really great conversations with folks about upcoming initiatives. I will say that in addition to this working group, there was also a reading group that formed several months ago. And kind of as opposed to a traditional quote-unquote reading group, the goal of that group is facilitating dialogue that will lead to tangible outcomes in the works that folks are doing, you know, individually or at their institutions, or that is the stated goal of the group. And we're also hoping to begin to engage more in community archives work, which we had done a bit in the past, but the pandemic and everything, obviously, we can't really do any in-person work along those lines, but we would like to, you know, start that up again. And there was some really great conversation at our last meeting, including a great suggestion from Valencia about creating, you know, possibly a toolkit for community organizations and community archives folks doing this work. So anyway, there's a lot of ideas and talk, but we would like to get back to doing more community archiving work.
Great. So we will close with our traditional closing question for the Archives in Context podcast, which is for each of you, if you could have a superpower, what would it be and why?
I'll go first. I thought long and hard about this. I would like to time travel, but as an observer, because the past is really smelly. So many smells, just whew. So I don't want to experience that, but I would like to be able to, you know, visit my ancestors, see where I come from, and then, you know, go to all the juicy, gossipy events throughout history, and then come back and report it to you and add to our description about them.
I originally had the same answer as Valencia, but I changed my mind. I play an awful lot of D&D and have for many years, and I have always wanted to be a druid, which they get all of the spells and can change into animals, and they just have a great time. So I'm very into that.
This is Katie. I actually like Valencia's answer a lot, but I won't take that one because I already have one. I have always wanted the ability to become invisible, just because I think the same reason, or one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons I'm an archivist is that I'm just super nosy and I like to know stuff. And I feel like if I was invisible, I could really get to know a lot of stuff.
Katie, you stole my answer.
That actually, it doesn't surprise me that you have the same answer as me.
Yeah, I want to be invisible because I like knowing what's going on everywhere, and like having the inside scoop.
This is Faith. I'm really bad at answering questions like this, but the first thing that came to my mind is I think as of now, I would like the ability to move at very fast speeds. It's maybe like Quicksilver or The Flash or something, because I have so much to do and that I want to do. And I'm the type of person that needs like at least 8 hours of sleep. So there's not a ton of time. So if I could just do everything super quickly, sometimes I'm a little bit of a turtle with some things, but I think that would be my superpower.
And I also have to say after this year that while I very much agree with Valencia's assessment of how smelly the past was, the past was also disease ridden and they didn't have vaccines. So
also food safety.
2021, not so bad.
Plumbing? It's just
no electricity.
No, like people are like, oh yeah, I want to go to the past. And I'm like, why? Ew.
I would like to go steal some of their textiles though and bring them back. The nicely made clothing.
So you just want to go to the past and like be a thief and come back. That sounds pretty awesome.
I mean, that sounds like a comic book.
An invisible time traveler who goes and steals from the aristocracy just clothing, though.
No jewels, just clothing.
So you can bring textiles back with you. You can observe, but not use all of your senses. I like this. All of these combined are perfect superpowers for Archivus. Moving really fast, selective time travel. I like it. Great. Well, thank you all so much for talking to us today and sharing your work on the anti-racist description resources and talking to us about how archivists can use these resources to support more ethical and inclusive descriptive practices in their work. So it was great speaking with you all today.
Thank you for having us. It was a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've just listened to an episode of Archives in Context, the official podcast of the Society of American Archivists. Members of the podcast team include Bethany Anderson, Chris Burns, Joy Ellen Freeman, Nicole Milano, Colleen McFarland Rademacher, and Anna Trammell. Opinions expressed in this podcast are our own and are not reflective of a particular institution. Be sure to like us on iTunes if you enjoyed what you heard, and join us again next time.